Yeah. Anyone else think this square is a
false advertisement?
Squares. We all know there's no square discs in Tron. Yeah, exactly. All right, here's what we've got. It's the exact same thing as Legacy, but with a square.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that isn't bad.
Cut print. Take it to theaters.
We actually had dinner with Steve Lisberger's house Saturday night, and we were talking about like how perfect the disc is and the round. And you know, Steve is such a philosopher that he was like talking about. Because when he did it, there was, you know, he wasn't thinking compact discs or anything else, and it's just like, it's unreal.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that he started with, you know, all those years ago.
Well, for him, it's, you know, it's the circle. It's the circle of life. It's the Dharma wheel. It's the, you know.
Yeah.
And oddly became prophetic. That's what we always say, is like, Steve was a visionary who predicted the future, and we're just two fans who was like, wouldn't it be cool if Flynn was stuck in the grid? And that's kind of how...
That's smart.
Yeah. That's how we started.
Nice. Did you have to go back and look at all the mythology? Because you kind of created some mythology on your own and then
we
worked kinda, off of what they did, right?
Yeah, you know, it oddly started because... Well, the very first...
Well, it really started.
Yes.
28 years ago, you know, as kids seeing the movie. I mean, did you guys all see it then? Or some of you have seen it then. But, yeah, and for those of you who have... I mean, I'm sure it was similar to what we had, which was like being dropped in the theater by parents who didn't quite understand what this movie would be, and then having your mind blown, and then running to the arcade after that, too.
I literally remember waiting 20 minutes in line with my one quarter, and there was all these teenagers above me, and they all looked really cool, and they had like whatever, and I finally got up to the machine, and I put my thing in, and I picked my game, and down. Died right away.
Yeah.
Literally, went 20 minutes and it was 5 seconds.
I liked the tank game because you could kind of make it last a little longer, even if you were bad. You can kind of turn around before you died. Light cycles would end too fast.
And I would never switch. I would always have to do light
cycles. MCP and it's coming up at you. Like that was just really stress inducing.
Yeah.
But that's when we started working on the sequel. We didn't know each other.
Our little, you know, I still oddly have my Clue in Sark toys. I have them in a box, and it's very weird. We always say this, one of our very first jobs out here was we wrote for the TV show Popular, which Ryan Murphy, who created Glee, did. And one of the subplots we did was two of the kids were grounded, and there was going to be a Tron screening, and Bruce Boxleitner
was
going to speak at it.
So the whole episode was around these two kids trying to get to a Tron screening with Boxleitner,
and then that was literally, and we told Bruce and Steve Lisberger that they're like, what?
Yeah, they were both,
what show is this? And we're like,
you didn't watch the WB.
I guess you guys were watching Dawson's Creek at the time, but oddly, Tron just stayed with us forever. And so, like, one day we were having this meeting, you know, with and they said, well, you know, Disney's been looking to do Tron. Would you guys be interested? And we're like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, well, you know what? They're not going to hire two TV. That's just not going to happen. So let's pitch the movie we'd want to see, right? And we went in and we met with Brig and then we met
Rick Shaler. I don't know if you guys know him. He's a great executive here at the company.
Yeah, he's real. You know, he's fantastic. He's been a huge champion and partner in all of this with us. And we pitched him our idea, and he said, you need to go meet with Sean Bailey, who's producing this. And we went to Sean, and we basically just sat down and we said, you know, well, what if, you know, the son, the father had been stuck in the grid, and the kid didn't know about it, and when he gets inside, he meets a 25-year-old version of his father that he doesn't realize, and then, you know, go from there. And we didn't even know if that was technically possible,
but
we
Sean,
were just, because we're like, we're not getting this job, so wouldn't it be cool if you, no, not one Flynn, two.
Because going back, it's like, you know, okay, you're looking to do another Tron. Well, obviously, there's Tron, there's Boxleitner.
And we never wanted to do a reimagination because we just thought that was, you know, what fired us up was when he lands on the NCOM building at the end of that movie, and he comes out in that double-breasted suit. We're like, what happens next? Mm. And for us, it was like, you can't redo something like this.
No,
it's blasphemous.
You have to honor it.
You have to honor it and love it.
And Flynn and Bridges was just such a like awesome character, and we loved Jeff Bridges so much. In our pitch, we were like, well, we got to have two of them.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And Sean goes, you know, Sean liked the pitch, and he goes, well, I have this guy, Joe Kaczynski. Have you seen his reel? And he shows us his reel, and his reel blows us away. In fact, there's a Nike commercial that you're like, oh, okay, that is Tron. And he goes, I want to do this differently. Instead of it being the old, you go off for 6 weeks, we give you notes, you go off. He goes, we're all going to sit down at a table together, and we're going to do this. And that was like 3.5 years ago. So it's like crazy seeing...
Yeah, it's
like... Being in that thing and seeing the theater, it's like there'll be scenes like them going down into the disc games, and I just remember being at Digital Domain, like, talking it out with everyone and, like, seeing the sketches, and it's like...
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing, like, we pitched this thing, like, yeah, it was summer, fall 2007.
It didn't even really hit me till I feel like this week that this is actually coming out and that this isn't just for us.
Because
now
it's just
been
something we've been working on. It's like,
I literally have nothing but fear and terror.
This could actually be in theaters.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, God, it's going to be judged. No, and, you know, it's one of those things, like, you know, we approach everything we've done, like, on Lost for 6 years and now this. It's always been as fans. It's been as, like, what do we love? What do we think is cool? And hopefully, you know, people will respond or not. We'll see. But,
right.
But that's, you know.
Either way, we'll cry.
It's terrible.
Either way, we're that fragile, so it doesn't matter.
Let me ask, when you guys, obviously, having worked on television, having worked on shows like Alias and Lost, which are other people's sandboxes when they...
Yeah.
Well, Alias, sure. We worked on Felicity and Lost.
Yes. But still, other people...
No more action.
Alias without the...
Yes.
Fun.
But as TV writers, awesome. When you come in and you're dealing with other people's characters and things, isn't that kind of a training ground for having stepped in and doing this, then picking up Lisberger's ideas
and
characters?
You know what? It absolutely is, because the key to being a TV writer is you are playing in someone's sandbox, but you have to say, how do I bring myself into it?
Right.
How do I find myself? And the perfect example is, I say this with Damon and Carlton, is season two I started pitching a guy in Lost called Neil Frogert. And they're like, who's that? And I was like, he's one of the Sox. His name's Frogert. And they're like, there's no one named Neil Frogert. I go, there's Frogert. And I just kept saying it until finally one day Damon was like, well, maybe we just get some guy out of the background, you know, like Frogert. And he just looked at me and he's like... So we cut to, we're all in Hawaii, and we're watching the premiere, and we're on the beach.
Final season,
now, this is the final season, this is this two-hour opus, you know, it's very, you know, Giacchino is pounding, and we're on the plane, and we see Boone and Locke for the first time, and sitting in between them with a sleeping mask is Frogert. And Damon and Carlton just turned around, they looked at me, and they go, you guys are just pulling the strings, aren't you? How did this happen? And that is the key, is you have to be able to figure out how to work within their offense.
And by the way,
yeah.
One other thing we did in Lost, it was season two or three with Hurley, his servants, the Trons.
Yeah, the Trons.
Yeah.
Always getting Trons. But the key is you have to come into someone's sandbox and you say, how do I find myself in here? How do I do something that creatively enriches me, but still is pushing the vision forward? And that's the thing with we always...
There have been a series of terrifying experiences on this process. And one one of the first was after, you know, we got the job, but now we had to go pitch Steven Lisberger and Jeff Bridges.
At Jeff Bridges' house. So we all drove up to Montecito.
And by the way, we have a movie that is based on two Flynns. He's not into this.
Oh, and by the way, when you're pitching the guy who created the world, and you're saying, this is it, if he turns to you and says, no, it isn't, you can't say, yes, it is, because he could say, well, let me tell you something, it's my world, and no. So we're driving up to Santa Barbara, and at this point, by the time I even get out of, like, L.A. County, I'm like, they hate me. This is not going to work. You know, go back to Minnesota. And we get up there, and the very first thing is you drive up Bridges' compound, and it's the Kenny Loggins house. Like, Kenny Loggins used to live there. So now I'm just like, fear. You come in, and he's got this table, and laid out are all the Tron toys and the original Tron helmet. And I was like, okay.
And when he said, do you want to wear it? We're like, yeah.
But now the embarrassing thing was, is like at a certain point in the middle of the meeting, we were there all day. Jeff goes, "Do you guys want to take a walk?" And we're like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Come on, man!" And we're walking up, and he's got this really great thing that overlooks it, and it's got the it's like the bodysuit and the Viking helmet,
just
from Big Lebowski.
Lying on the ground, and
like the Zen Garden
is the body cast from Lebowski for that suit of armor.
So he's like, "Hey, why don't one of you put the..." Because he takes pictures, you know, he takes those panoramic pictures.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, you two, do a prom picture. And we're like, what? He's like, yeah, put the helmet on. And I mean, you mean prom, like me on a tree? And
no,
he's like, no, man.
picture somewhere.
Fucking put your arms around it, man. Let's plumb. So I put the helmet on. Adam's behind me. Now, the two of us haven't hugged ever.
But okay? When Jeff Bridges asks you to do something, you do it.
But when Kevin Flynn says hug, you go, yes, sir. So there's a shot somewhere. I don't know if it'll ever be released. And me and Adam literally like this.
The
Tron helmet on. It's
the cover of the next book.
Exactly.
But, oh boy. But but they were both incredibly cool and incredibly collaborative and, like, you know, they had awesome ideas and we're all really encouraging for the whole
process.
It's been
a great experience for us because we know all the horror stories of writing, going from TV into movies, and this was so collaborative and, you know, Sean Bailey and everyone and Joe Kaczynski created such an environment of collaboration that it was like this dream project.
It was really incredible group, and Joe, you know, can't really say enough about, like, his...
Describe him as he has come from the future to teach us technology. That's the only way I can describe Joe Kaczynski. Because his eyes, I mean, when you watch him look at a... Even, like, when we're taking a break and we're watching TV, and you just see the way he looks at it, and you see him, and you're like, oh, that's why he's a director.
But also, this is his first feature, and a feature of this size and scope, he was... ice and cool, and knew what he wanted the whole way. It was like, I remember the first night of shooting. We were in Vancouver, and we're on the set, and it was that motorcycle shot you see in the trailers, and of Sam kind of jumping off an off ramp, and so there's like six blocks shut down and lights everywhere.
Meanwhile, Adam and I are sitting there, and they pull these chairs that say Tron on it, and we realize we're jumping up and down,
yeah,
and hugging
Tron!
Sean Bailey. We did it.
We're shooting the movie. Joe is just. I focused on the whole thing and getting in the professional shot, guys.
Like, Tron! We literally probably acted like we snuck onto the set and were stealing props.
We tried. We did.
How complicated was the sort of history Bible outside the movie? Because the viral seems incredibly intense, and I just read the comic book.
Mm-hmm. There is a very comprehensive mythology that is in a constant sort of state of development throughout this whole process. And this is one of the great things, like, while we were writing the script and while we were working with Joe and Sean and Justin Springer, one of the other producers, we were building out this mythology over the last 3 years. So it is very... It snakes out in a lot of different directions.
And it's cool for us because, you know, because we come from TV, we're so used to just, you know, a world and seeing... And I think what's so great about technology now is you can tell stories... in different platforms, you know, it's like, you know, and that's what's fun, is like the ARG, it's like getting able to, you know, like, we got to, you know, write that press conference, that NCOM thing. I remember sitting in a room with Bruce and Cindy Morgan, and they were going over it, and we were about to jump someone out of a helicopter, and I was like, this is the greatest thing ever, you know, like, this is, you know, and so...
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and it's been really daunting, but it's one of the things about it, though, is, like, for us, it's like...
You got to dig deeper, I think.
Right. When you have a movie that's going to be, you know, in the two-hour range or whatever, there's only so much you can show within the film, but if you can create a mythology that is really dense and deep and hopefully well thought out, that you hopefully can create a sense that there's stuff happening on the edges, that there's stuff that's informing everything that's going on, so that if you do respond to it and you do look into it, you can find that there are other little storylines going on within the movie and things to be thinking about and things to discover. And that's something that really, like, over all the years on Lost, I think really helped us get to, which is the idea of really trying to make the world as deep and vast as you can.
I'm sorry. Speaking of the press conference that you brought it up, I know it ended a little... I was watching the live stream. I wasn't there. And the diver was having real problems. It was amazing. It was amazing he just didn't die.
You know what?
That was one of the most terrible...
He wasn't supposed to jump.
Well, oh, okay. Well, that's what I was going to ask is that... Because I remember Bruce... was like, he finished what he was saying, and then there was a pause, and he goes, I knew this was going to happen, and I could tell, by the way, we're off the script now, so I want to know what was the plan.
The plan was we gave him some stretching room, and we're like, if at the most, just start rallying about this, and we did it. We didn't think what was going to happen was it was really bad weather
and windy,
and you know, the first thing is to do this jump, we literally had to be approved by Homeland Security. So that's... what was amazing is 42 Entertainment got that clearance, but it was really bad out, and they weren't supposed to jump. So, like, we were waiting for the helicopter, and you can literally, all of a sudden, the guy just is like, man, fuck it up. And we're looking up, and we're jumping, and we were sitting there. It was us, and we were with Joe and Sean and Justin, and I was just looking up, and I was like,
the guy is like spinning
like,
around.
Yeah, you're
like
this may be.
Out.
I was like, this may be the one stunt that ruins all of it. And I was like, I could not imagine being the guy that has that's like, yeah, fuck it, I'll do it.
Man, he landed like behind the set. It looks like there was 20 feet clearance.
Oh yeah, it was perfect landing. It was
sort of. Well, it was really.
And they sort of hustled him in a car.
Listen, you know, I mean, he made a sacrifice for Tron, and we thank him.
Obviously, this is an effects-driven film, but it seems like the story in the film centers around this father-son relationship. I was wondering, what was the process creating this tentpole film around a father-son dynamic?
For us, it was kind of the entry point into it, because when we were thinking about the story, we thought, well, you know, we love Tron, but we want to bring in new people to love Tron, and whose eyes are they going to do it through? And for us, we just thought, you know, it was just like, you know, for us, we need an emotional spine to kind of take us into the story, or else we can't. Or else it just becomes a bunch of moves or gags and stuff. And even though those are really fun to write, we just, you know, and that's, I think that's, it just seemed natural to us. And it's funny because Lisberger always says, he's got a son who's, and they look so much alike, we called him Clue. And but he was like, you're writing the story of me and my son. I was like, no, we're writing the story. It's like
well,
our
like
generations
for, like,
in a
for
weird
us,
way.
It was. If we're going to revisit this movie and try to take it forward, we're the children of Tron. Like,
yeah.
We grew up on it. It informed us. It really helped shape us and get us excited about the possibilities of technology and film and all that stuff. And it's one of the reasons we're doing what we're doing. So in that way, it's like, how can we approach this movie in a way as writers where we have an emotional entry point ourselves?
And for us, we wanted to answer a mystery, which was, what has happened to Kevin Flynn in 28 years? Well, we could obviously just have him turn around and say, well, here's where I've been, guys. Let me bore you for 2 minutes with exposition you won't remember. And we thought, no, let's make it a mystery and let's discover it through his son. And then it's like you get it, you know. And what's interesting to us is, you know, I mean, what would it be like if your father was a legend? You know, Kevin Flynn to us was Steve Jobs and Bill Gates all wrapped up into one, and John Lennon. So what if that was your dad? And everyone's like, just be as good as him. Oh, okay. I'll just invent the internet, you know. So for us, there was a lot of, like, you know, it's living up to who your father is at the same respect of being your own man and that the respect of finding out who your dad really was. You know, because when you see in the movie, it's kind of like, you know, Flynn is this legend and Sam has to kind of find the man that was his dad.
How much of the when it comes to the viral campaign, was that something that you guys initiated or was that the marketing had initiated that? And how much did you shape the actual way it's gone so far?
Well, I guess it's, you know, we had previously done a little bit of it on Lost, and Sean Bailey read this Wired article that 42 Entertainment did this really cool Nine Inch Nails thing, and
they also did the Dark Knight campaign.
Yeah, and the Dark Knight campaign.
They're the best,
and we just thought this movie lends itself to that. And you know, I mean, you're talking to two guys who created a fake band on Lost, and then got the network to actually pay for us to record it and put it on iTunes. So like for us, any little tangent we can follow, we will do it. And so we were like, this naturally lends itself. And we got 42 Entertainment and Susan and Alex, and they're so great. And I think, you know, again, it's collaboration.
Yeah.
Because for us, it's important that everything in Tron is, you know, you want it to all feel of a piece. You don't want to be like, well, the comic doesn't link into this, and that
the
doesn't link into that. Because that's not fun. What's fun is getting
to
broaden
the
world. So we've been lucky that we've been able to work with them, but I have to give them credit for, like, all the cool stuff, like the Flynn's Arcade. I mean, that's really them. You know, we might help on the mythology side, and we may write some scenes or stuff for them, but
they put together this massive thing that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we're impressed with them.
To some extent, it's almost, it feels philosophically right for Disney, because, like, when you go to the parks, the rides start way back at the beginning of the line,
right?
They have all the atmosphere and the gravestones, and the thing. Before you ever get inside, you've already had an experience.
You know, if God willing, there actually are lines to see the movie, like, we want them to do those zigzag lines.
But it kind of feels like months out, you guys have already started. For the dedicated fans, they're kind of already immersed in Tron. The theater's almost the last step of that for them.
I really think, again, it is because all of us are fans of Tron, so we are literally doing this movie like fans, and so for us, it's like, the movie is so technologically advanced. Like, it's taking a while, obviously, to complete. But for us, it's like, let's do cool stuff now. you know, let's get this out. And I think it's, you know, we're excited. We hope people like it. We don't know if they will, but we've had a really, you know, like for us, it's been a dream to work on.
Yeah. Plus, it's like it's the perfect movie to do an internet based ARG campaign because.
Right.
It operates on that level in the story, so the fake ARG world is still seamless with the movie because that's where it exists.
Yeah,
if it does,
right. And the hope is that for the people who do follow that and are involved with the ARG, that they will get a lot of payoffs when they see the movie.
What I love about it, as you guys saw the Jerry Garcia picture in my hand, I was a deadhead, and I love the community of it. I love that I could go somewhere, and if I saw another guy with a dancing bear on his shirt, I could go, hey, man, did you go to Alpine this summer? And he could say, yeah. And that's what I love about the internet. It's like your guys' sites. Like, I don't know you, but a lot of your sites we will go to every day, or we'll see the names, and now I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. It's there's a community.
No, I mean,
it feels
I was
like,
joking before, but it's true. It is like looking at my web browser favorites page, you know?
It's like there is a community, and you're like, oh, there are geeks like me out there who are interested in the same stuff I care about, which my wife completely doesn't. She was like, this year I'm going to Comic-Con. This year I'm going to Comic-Con. And I said, okay. You ready? Because I'm going to spend an entire afternoon looking for action figures. 2 minutes on the floor, she bought a t-shirt for my son, looked up and goes, oh, I get it. It's a bunch of shit I don't care about. I said, that's right. See you at the spa. I'm going to go find a Planet of the Apes doll.
In the last couple of years, we go away for Comic-Con for like those 4 or 5 days, and our wife's like, what are they doing there that's so much fun? Shouldn't I be there?
Right, like, they're picturing the Playboy Mansion. They're literally picturing us, like, and they don't realize what it really is.
Which is awesome, but it is, as Eddie said, it's that community.
That's what we love about it.
Yeah, it's that feeling of, like, if you're part of some large community of like-minded people, and, you know, and it's fun. And
I got in an elevator with a guy dressed as Dean Venture, and I thought that was so cool. My wife's like, what's that? And I was like...
It takes so long to explain. Well, this Comic-Con in particular had to be really, really special for you guys then, because it was, you know, saying...
It was emotional.
I mean, and the last couple of years with Lost wrapping up and that having such a huge presence, and with Tron having really had its big moment, its big zeitgeist announcement moment there, it's really become sort of a very closely connected to the experience you guys have had.
Yeah, I mean, we always say this, but the fans of Comic-Con are responsible, because when the test for this got snuck there, the response in both Comic-Con and the boards was so great that I feel like it really helped greenlight the movie, because it made people, you know, listen, we all, you know, we love Tron, but that doesn't mean everybody in the corporate level may be as big a fan as us, but this showed them that there was a built-in fan base, and that, you know, they could see what Joe wanted to do with it, and we really, you know, we say the fans got this made.
You were talking about your writing from the fan point of view. When you were developing this story individually, was there one ultra cool Tron thing from the original, a character, technology, a person that you said, this has to be in the movie for me. This is the one thing that I want to get in.
You
and
know,
just...
it's funny because there's a few Easter eggs, and you probably maybe caught them today. The first one is Sam just taking his shirt off and changing it. Because if you remember in the original Tron, that's what Bridges does.
In his place, he's doing that.
We wanted that ColecoVision. We have little Easter
there's
eggs
like
that.
DeMond.
But yeah, for us, DeMond. You know, I mean, obviously we wanted to have light cycles because, I mean, it was just a dream to be able to write edit forms. And we wanted, you know, we really wanted Flynn's Arcade. You know, there was just touchstones from the movie that we really
walking
think,
onto
wanted.
The set of Flynn's Arcade was just that was mind blowing. That was one of those moments where we were like,
was Journey actually playing, or did you just have to hear?
Journey was in our script from the first draft on the Journey song, and it's, you know, and it was like seeing that recreated, and, you know,
yeah, forever, always. Well, wonder. Wouldn't it be great if Steve Perry came out and sang during our Tron panel? And they're like, what in the world do you do? The one where I think Steve Perry would want to do that, I guess.
Cool,
I mean, actually. That's the world I'm living in.
No, and then,
I guess in not reality.
The night that the first trailer premiered with Alice in Wonderland, like, we all went out with, like, Joe and Sean,
Justin Springer
Justin
and
Garrett
was with us.
And we went to dinner in the restaurant in Flynn's Arcade, like in Culver City, which is like if you go down there, it still looks exactly the same on the outside. You're just going to imagine the
But for us, you know, we really, you know, when we came into this, we were like, well, we have, you know, we're in Steve Lisberger's sandbox, but we have to make our own world. And for us, we didn't want to do an internet movie. like, oh no, it's spam. Get your diss out. You know, for us, Toronto's a world. The way that Oz is a world. The way that, you know, and so for us, that's what we wanted to honor. And we wanted to say, well, Flynn got out from that last experience. What would he do if he started over and said, I'm going to make my own grid? You know, and that's to us what was important. That's kind of how we. So the grid is in a lot of ways a reflection of Kevin Flynn, and his son going into it was kind of like his son going into his father's brain in a weird way. And the 28-year-old version, the 35-year-old version of Flynn was, you know, what we love is, you know, Jeff is such a deep, deep guy, you know, and he's such a great thinker, and it's like, well, Jeff Bridges at 35 is different than Jeff Bridges now, just like Kevin Flynn at 35 was probably a huge egomaniac on top of the world. And so now he has to be constantly reminded of all the things he hates about himself every day. And that's kind of how we started to approach this in these kind of weird ways.
It's interesting the Oz comparison you guys make, because from that first trailer where we see the older Bridges turn around, you can't help but think of him as the wizard.
Yeah.
As the guy who's kind of up there and kind of responsible for a lot of what you see in the world itself. Was that a touchstone in some way?
It was one of many. I mean, it's we wear our influences on our sleeves very often, and that was one of them. And Oz, you know, Wizard of Oz being one of those first movies that as a kid really affects you, but it's also one of those first movies really about transporting you to another place, and that's, you know, gets into like just the experience of going to a movie and a really great movie that can just take you somewhere
else.
They
both have a very similar DNA, which is Tron really lives on, you know, in a lot of ways trying to get home.
Right.
Mm. You know, you're put into this world and you want to get home, and what is home? You know, and that's I think what in a lot of ways inspired us.
Was that the choice to do the 2D to the 3D as the same as Wizard of Oz goes, the black and white to the color? Was that the kind of...
You know, that would be a better question for Joe. It just naturally led... I think just the structure of it lent itself more for that. Joe has such a great vision for this movie. Like, even from day one, like, we would have meetings like this, and we would be talking about the disc games, and we'd be like, oh, there could be brackets and whatever. We'd then drive from Venice back to Burbank, so 3 hours later, and there would be a call. It'd be Joe, and he'd be like, I'm sending you guys a sketch of this. And they're undulating platforms. And you would look at it, and it would be great because the half-formed idea we all thought of, you know, we knew the character stuff we wanted to be on it, and then Joe would tell you what it is, so then you could literally write specifically, so you could say, oh, he smashes the glass and something goes. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can you talk about, there's certainly the viral stuff going on, but there's also the bigger Disney, you showed the Mickey Mouse in your office, and like Marvel Comics is doing the Tron covers, the sort of stuff. Can you talk about the company sort of embracing that?
There's so many things they're doing. I can tell you that Disney has been really supportive over this project in to a way that I've never seen before. And it's really cool in how they're...
Look, this is our first movie, so it's like, for us, this is incredibly overwhelming. It's like, it's amazing.
And we have nothing to compare it to or reference to.
Every movie we've done this
in. In fact, I don't want to say who, but someone at Disney looked at me, and because we had just come from seeing like a bunch of stuff they were doing, and he looked at me, and they had that Toronto rail, and Lenny looked at me and he goes, you know, not all the movies you make here are going to have their own monorails. And I'm like, why not?
Well, we're one for one.
So I guess I'll aim lower. I don't. But yeah, it's like they've been really supportive, and it's great to have things like that. Like, I looked at those Marvel covers and I was like, that's really cool. Yeah, you know what? A lot of them lend themselves to that. So they've been really supportive the whole time. Really every level. Like, Disney has been a huge, you know, partner, and they've been so supportive of the project. And in a way, like, you know, it feels like when you'll start talking to all the people around Disney, they're fans like we are of it, and that's what's cool.
There's a culture at Disney of there's a lot of people here who have worked here for a really long time, and it's a family, and it's a really great place that way. There are a lot of people here who have worked on the original Tron, and there are a lot of people who feel like a real fondness for the property and an excitement about it, and I think that's sort of permeating everything. I think there's a genuineness behind all the stuff they're doing that at least we sense that feels really, really cool.
Yeah.
When looking at the very tail end of the footage that we saw today, obviously one of the things that we've been teased with repeatedly now in footage, the light jets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that seems like such a great ramping up from the idea of a light cycle.
Right.
But it also seems geometrically, just to wrap your head around how you then build an action sequence with light jets, it seems crazy.
Writing that one was...
Was there ever a moment where you guys came up with an idea that you threw at Joe and he goes, I don't even know how I would do that?
No.
That's awesome. That's
you have to understand, Joe Kaczynski is not someone who... You have to understand, he went to Stanford for, like, astrophysics and,
he's got a
mechanical engineering, and I mean, it's like, there is
invented polio vaccine.
Literally.
A lot of stuff he's done.
Yeah. I mean, literally.
But,
and so
yeah,
there was,
but he
there
was never
nothing
fazed
he was
by anything. Like, we would brainstorm ideas, and he'd be like, oh, this is how I'll shoot this, and this is how it'll look. And then, like, we'd write it, we'd get notes from him, and then we'd be able to figure out. It was just an incredible back
and light chats were just, I mean, literally, like, you know, we always talk about this, but basically what happened is we had an outline. And Sean Bailey said, let's all go to, let's get our Blackberries, let's throw them out, and let's all lock ourselves in a hotel room. And yeah, let's not kid ourselves. And lock ourselves in a room, you know, a hotel room for 2 days and really just talk about this movie. And we all went to La Quinta in summer. So it was 108 out.
This was not a Charlie Sheen weekend.
Yeah.
This was, like, we locked ourselves in this room.
This was literally wouldn't it be cool if there were light jets weekend? And we
took the outline and we kind of went through it all.
We couldn't believe Disney was paying for this. Like, literally, they were paying for us to stay in a hotel room and talk about light jets.
No, we feel like we've pulled the
con Disney so
hard of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and we sat there, and for that weekend, just kind of going over everything in the story. Really, the movie that we all hopefully see soon is.
We showed you an outline that we wrote. We wrote after that weekend. We wrote what we called the scriptment, which was 60 pages. So at that point, we might as well have just put dialogue in, but.
There was not. It was a sort of hybrid script, and I mean, you guys know what it is. And coming out of that weekend, we wrote that.
But literally, that's pretty much where we are today. I mean, that the stuff we discussed at that weekend became legacy.
Yeah, that was in like spring of 08, and then over that summer, we built out the script, and then by the fall, we were greenlit.
Yeah. It's funny because we come from TV where it's like I write something today, and next week it's shot, and I see it 2 weeks from now. And in movies, you're like, "Wow, you guys, this is really fast. 3 years. You'll get a lot. Movies, you'll get a lot of this. You'll get a lot of this. We got you guys. We need this right now so we can film this in 18 months. Okay.
Is there a different process that you go through when you're writing a big action scene versus a small character moment?
For me, on a technical level, yes, there is some, but really on a very basic level, it always comes down to, I think for me, like, what's the audience going to feel? What do we want them to experience from this on an emotional level? And how are we telling the story from it? So the approach is always the same that way.
Yeah, you're always trying to, because the best action scenes are the ones, that come from character. You know, if you look back at your favorite scenes and... So we always try to do that, and it's all hard, and Tron is so difficult to write because there's just so many, it's so complex.
It is very complicated world, and to try to find that kind of the emotional truths in it and the kind of the simplicity behind it, it was the challenge, whether it was an action scene or a dialogue scene between a father and son.
Well, the brilliance of Joe and his test and his visuals were, I could say, if you had to pitch the movie to somebody, you could say, light cycle, there it is, right behind you. Whereas if you've never heard of Tron before and you're trying to explain what this is,
it's hard.
Trust me, we've done it a couple times and we die. Literally, there's people like, I don't understand what you're saying to me at all.
You guys talk about that first meeting with Steve and Jeff and stuff. What was Steve's impression of that pitch for the film?
He loved it, and I was very, very shocked. And then it wasn't till we really, we talk to Steve all the time, we see him all the time, and I realized we tapped into what he was feeling because with him and his son. And so in Steve's mind, we wrote his life. And in our mind, it's like, no, we're your son, we're trying to please you. You don't get it. We're the fans that are trying to get Daddy to tell us we did a good job. But
yeah, Steve is Flynn, and, and our generation is his son. And there was that back and forth really felt kind of cool and really natural with us, and he's been an incredible supporter.
We call him Obi-Wan because he literally is. It's like, and Steve has this ability to, Adam and I can come to him with just unmolded clay, just stuff that makes no sense, and he will be able to understand it, reach into it and say, guys, here's what you're trying to do, go do that. We're like, right.
I'm talking about your early pitch. Was there any specific concept or set piece that you had in mind at that time that didn't make it into the film, that got out of it, or was it...
There were some few things.
There's always stuff that falls out.
There was some city stuff we wanted to do, like really get into the city a little more, that we just couldn't, we just didn't have time to do for this because of the nature of the story. But oddly, it pretty much...
What happens is there'll be set pieces you write or things you write that like you, as you go through draft to draft, we find that it's like, oh, we can tell the story clearer and more simply and more in our minds, at least more effectively, by kind of honing things down and, you know, and trying to really keep a very lean, strong focus on the storytelling.
But pretty much, I think, you know, most of it got in.
I mean, if you're asking, are there any great disappointments of things that got left out? No. I mean, I think that the things that were excised from early drafts and whatever, all, you know, were all in service of trying
for the better.
Yeah, they were all for the better, and everything was in service of trying to tell the story the best way we could.
Is that because you were starting from the father-son story, so really nothing was going to get too far out conceptually because that was the center line of your story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for us, I don't know, it's a weird process. It was just the journey we set them on, you know, just kind of lent itself to a structure that we just kind of stayed with, and that was the spine of the movie. So there wasn't like, oh, we had this underwater scene we had to cut. I mean, there was nothing.
No, it's this weird thing, and it's the thing we always, you know, we talked about on Lost a lot, too, which is like we would say the show is telling us to do something, and in some ways the movie starts...
The grid, yeah. The we grid always say Tron is not a job, it's a lifestyle.
It starts to tell you, you know, you don't need this. It's got to be this way. And
you know, you don't, you know, for us, again, you know, we just wanted to be what's the most... You know, what's the story that we thought was, that people we think would enjoy? You know, you don't want to be self-indulgent, which is very easy in these worlds to be like, our mythology is gold. You know, it's like, well, you know, this is people are coming back into this, and we want to tell a fun story for everybody, and we don't, you know, we're not, you know, we're not.
But it's like, yeah. Again, going back to that mythology thing of trying to make it as kind of deep and far-reaching as possible. There's characters in the movie, like in any movie, that are in it for a few lines and have a couple scenes, but to us, there is a much larger backstory to all of them.
It's like when you got... Remember when they released the Cantina figures? And you're like, wow, I don't really remember these guys because I only saw this 3 times in the theater and I didn't get to pause it, but like, I want to know more about...
Like, I want to know Bosk's story.
Right.
And just, you know, but...
You may get Bosk's story. I think Bosk, you know, has a really rich story, and he's on Match.com. He's out there dating.
You want to know
about
something that cut that upset me? I'm Lost. I wrote a speech about Bosk that got cut.
We'll do the last couple questions.
Yeah. By the way, the things that we did get cut on Lost, we will still remind Damon.
Oh, yeah.
there's still things we won't let go on that. Be like, well, that would have been better if I got my way.
Who gave the boss the speech? Was it Hurley?
It was Hurley.
Yeah.
It was in the Hurley Miles episode.
Yeah. A version of the speech remained. It was where
to
he
be
talked
fair
about.
To Lost, and I love my partner here, Adam. It was 3 pages.
It was a lot.
it involved Sarlacc and...
The Sarlacc reference remains.
Yeah, but it was literally 3 pages of Bosk, and Damon and Carlton looked at us, and they're like...
It's well written.
Either we're going to cut it, or you're going to cut it. And Adam was like, you, I love it all.
Pretty much.
What was the inspiration for some of the other characters in Tron, like the Living Wild character and James Frayn's character, Michael Sheen's character? Mm-hmm. Like, where did you get the inspiration to... Like, was it, like you said, like, out of the necessity of the story that you had already built?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for the... It's hard to say. Like, for us, it was like... It'll be easier to talk about these things once you see the whole movie.
Because there's certain things about the characters that we don't want to talk about before the movie comes out.
Because we don't want to spoil it. But they all have a reason.
And they all tie into what the story is. So they grow out of it, and then you can kind of sort of have the fun of, like, what could be a fun way to do these characters? And then when you meet the actors and when they cast, and then... You know, Olivia and Michael Sheen and James Frayn, they all brought such unique things to the characters.
It was important on 2 levels. One is what happened to Kevin Flynn. That's the mystery of the movie that we want you to ask. And the second one is, what's the grid like? You know, what's going on there? Does it have its own world? You know, what makes it a world as opposed to just a place for us to run through? And that's, you know, and these characters were part of the population for us that not only helped tell the story, but hopefully give the world, you know, a little more substance. I understand that you're writing the third Tron film. I was wondering what the process is of writing for another sequel when the sequel isn't even out yet. Or...
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Really, we've been focusing on this one, and as we say, like, it's not out of presumption. It's not out of, like, this is going to be so good. It's more out of, like, if people... if we are lucky enough to have people like this and want another one, if we don't think about it now, it won't come out till 2018, literally. And so it'll be like, yay, enjoy Tron in 20 years. So we really have been focusing on this one and not really working very much on the sequel. But to say that we don't have ideas on different ways to tell stories in Tron would be a lie as well.
We saw Sam's dog. Are there Tron dogs?
There are no Tron dogs.
That's in the sequel.
You're talking about,
but I might steal that for the sequel because I've got nothing.
When you were talking about the Tron world, one of the things when I first saw the earliest material from this that I thought was kind of a really geeky mind lore was the fact that there was weather.
Yeah.
In that world, is that something? I mean, I know in the original movie they had, you were that overshot, you had really geometric clouds. Was that just a natural development, or was that Kevin Flynn saying, I'm here, I want weather?
It's one of those things, though. It's a couple of things, and seeing the movie will help explain some of it. But part of it is that just in the natural evolution of technology over from a 1982 grid to a 1989 grid to whatever, it's the complexity and the simulation of the world has grown in such a way that things that were just geometric clouds in the first Tron, in this one, would now, to us, logically have...
And that's, Joe Kaczynski, like, that was really, like, you know, a lot of that development of the grid and things like that, just really him, you know?
Plus it just looks bitchin'.
Yeah.
No, but he has, Joe had we had many, many conversations with him about this over the years, and he had a very kind of clear vision for that kind of stuff about how the grid would develop and how...
Because the grid is a character in a way of itself, and it has to evolve the way characters do. And, you know, Joe is so precise, he actually had a map of the grid up, so we always knew which way we were moving. And this map was just gorgeous. Like, he just made it himself, right? And all we wanted was that map. And he knew that the two of us would put it up in the Lost office immediately because that's who we are. And he was like, no, these are all secrets. We're like, we won't put it up.
Right? Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys, for coming. I hope you like it.